Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. Hope I didn't sound like Darth Vader to you, did to me, but we're ironing out some little technical issues here since moving over to Station 2, and hopefully we'll get it resolved before Jesus comes. Welcome to the show on this November the 15th on the West Coast, now November the 16th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd also like to welcome anyone listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world. Had a very interesting two-hour visit there today where we talked about the missile crisis off the coast of Santa Catalina Island in California, and basically debunked the disinformation coming out in that regard. And if we need to some more, we will, but hopefully that puts that issue to rest. And as we have more information in that regard, we'll share it with you, as we always do. Tonight's guest is a naturopath, a PhD. He is an author and a lecturer. And he hosts his own show. I should throw in there journalist, too, because he's penning a lot of great original research articles. And we're going to talk about his latest one tonight. He hosts his own show on the Micro Effect Network. And the show is called The Story Behind the Story. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight with my good friend and yours, Dr. A. True. True, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Don. It's always a pleasure to be with you tonight and on Monday nights, as the case may be. You know, it's talk about a lot of radio. I was on myself on an hour before my show tonight, and we talked about the Kennedy assassination story that, you know, yeah, even though it's 1963 is when it happened, I think it's timeless. I think that the story of September 11th will continue to be a hot topic as people come to realize the lies and falsehoods put out by our government and the cover-up. Same people, same groups. You look at the people, Henry Kissinger and others that were involved back in 1963. They still, they're timeless. I don't know what it is that they keep eating or drinking, as the case may be.
I think they're getting a few organ transplants, maybe some free stem cell material as well.
Or something. But the group that I'm affiliated up with now, since actually August, the group called BattleHymn.com, the website that's going up there, and it's designed to be kind of a one-stop shop for the Christian patriots, so-called. And there's just a lot of good information coming there. The book, Battle Hymn, should be going to press pretty quickly. It's a kind of pretty much encyclopedia of problems facing America the last 20, 25 years and looking, hopefully, for solutions to the problems in the future. But the founder the man behind Battle Hymn is a man named Dane Phillips, who I met back in August when I lectured at the Axiom Conference, the Truth Tellers Conference, so-called, there in Salt Lake City. And he was impressed, I guess, with what he heard from me, and we basically hit it off. He asked me to help with the content of the website, the battlehymn.com website. There's some information there that I think is timely concerning the Catholic Church and its origins. A series of videos, like a 20-some-odd part series of YouTube videos on the Vatican and really the corruption that's there with Cardinal Ratzinger taking the active role as taking the new name of Pope Benedict. So anyway, the people there that are tied up with Battle Hymn asked me to fill in a part of the website specifically on the end time religion. And that's a very fascinating subject to me, because it's not just one set religion that's going to flat out take over the world or has designs to do so. Rather, it's a group of individual religions with a unifying demon at the top of the food chain, so to speak, that's making it run. And so that's what we talked about. You talked about at the first of the show. It's the paper that I authored, which is really just a start of the subject matter. It really goes deep into unraveling the mystery of the Book of Revelation. And so that's kind of what we start out with, mm-hmm. to understand the religion of the beast. A real series of strong clues are given us in the second chapter of Revelations, and where Christ identifies through John in verse 9. He says, "I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich." that first sentence is amazing. When you look at it, it's an anomaly, isn't it? I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but they're rich. How can they be in poverty if they are rich? Well, he's talking about spiritual poverty here.
Yeah,
the tribulation they're working and is bringing them spiritual tribulation and spiritual not only poverty but famine, even though they are filthy rich in many cases. And this is the key sentence: I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Again, this is Revelation, the book of Revelation 2, verse 9. Now, I really began to just really dissect that one verse and other verses in chapter 2, Don. And I'm just amazed with what I uncovered myself. I didn't have any idea that I would find this thread and then keep pulling on it. So that's what the paper is all about. I titled it "The End Time Unified Religion of the Beast," is what I call it. So the word synagogue is not really a Yiddish or what we would call Jewish term at all. It goes back into the original Greek. It's a Greek word, in fact, not Yiddish. It literally means a congregation or just simply an assembly of men. And so, you know, the true body of Christ, the true Christians, Christ is warning them to watch out for this assembly. But then I thought, well, just for the heck of it, what is the term Jew? I mean, really, what does it mean? Is this really in the original text of the Bible? And to understand that terminology is it opening up a whole new world of meaning in the New Testament, even the Old Testament of the King James Version of the Bible. You know, there's 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, Don. There is not now, nor there has there ever been in the Hebrew alphabet, an equivalent letter of the word J. Did you realize that?
Yes, and that excludes that word, doesn't it, at least?
You know, it would have to. It would have to then.
Yeah.
And ditto with Greek. Okay, there's no Greek letter J, a consonant, or the sound J. So even in the English alphabet, we find that this is a fairly recent addition to English script. It was inserted in the English alphabet, I found, by a man named Petras Ramos in the middle 16th century. He distinguished that the vowel I and J represent separate individual sounds. So, for an example, as I write and explain that John chapter 19, verse 19, refers to the inscription on the cross that Pontius Pilate had posted over Jesus' cross. The Greek translation is Eos Nazorius Basileus Laudius, which in modern Bibles, in our modern Bibles, is totally and accurately rendered Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Not there was no Jesus in the wording of the Greek. There was no word Jew in the Greek. We find that 4th century A.D., Jerome translated the Bible from the Greek into Latin, and his treatment of this same verse in the Latin Vulgate was simply Jesus Nazarenus Rex Ludarium. The acronym is just four letters, I-N-R-I. Mm-hmm. If you see these Catholic statues around the Vatican, a lot around Rome, when you see a statue of Christ or even depicting his crucifixion, it has the insignia I-N-R-I. That's what it stands for.
As does the Orthodox Church, too.
So, yeah, the Latin Vulgate, going back into 1380, is the earliest version we have of the New Testament in English, the so-called Wycliffe edition of the Bible. We find that there is not a single word of the Jew, called Jew, in that entire Bible in 1380. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the word for the for Jesus is I-E-W-E, Hueh, or Yahweh. It can also be pronounced that I-E-W-E. The word Jew is just simply non-existent in the Wycliffe edition. So where did it come from?
Yeah.
Where did it?
You could be more specific and say, where did Jew come from?
Yeah, what'd you come from? So it's safe to say, and I think it's most biblical scholars that are honest will tell you that it became a modern invention, likely from the early 18th century, early 1700s. You get the Vatican again. The Rothschild bloodline began to really put out this text, translating or using the word to describe a group of people, bloodline or otherwise. And I've, in my research, Don, it comes out there's three basic groups that the term Jew can be used to describe if you go back to the original Vulgate text, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's the Israelites, which are basically the house of Israel. You got then the Judahites, which are specifically the descendants of the tribe of Judah, which we know in the Old Testament are the spiritual heirs of the promise of the lineage of David. And then we have also the so-called Judeans. Now, in the time of Christ, and in going back 600 years before the time of Christ, the whole geographic area of Judea not only included Palestine and Jerusalem proper, but if you look at the ancient maps, it included all the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, which is known today as modern Iraq, and of course the city of Baghdad. But back in 600 BC, that was better known as Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Judea included the physical remnants of ancient Babylon in 0 BC, or beginning in the Common Era. Okay. Wow. So those three things could be interchanged by the description, just the simple word Jew in the New Testament. And that can be very confusing. And I really believe it was done by design. It was easy. It should be easy for the King James translators, okay, the churchmen, the holy men, to put Israel where Israel should be, Judahites where Judahites should be, and Judeans or even Babylonians in the term of Judeans, because there's a context of that as well. So you see, I think it was done completely to obfuscate and to create a new structure of the Khazars.
Mm-hmm. The Judeans would have been the direct descendants of, let's say, the Hebrew peoples, who were of the bloodline of Abraham. Would they not?
The Judahites would be.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I mean, the ancient Hebrew people.
Right. That would be the Judahites, and even into the Israelites, the house of Israel. But see, where it becomes confusing, I think by design, is the Judeans, which are, again, could be just as much, if not more so, the Edomites, the direct descendants of Esau, which goes back, of course, to Babylon, and it could just well be called the Babylonians as the Judeans, but they were all called the Jews, and so you have to kind of sort through the context going back to the Vulgate to figure out who's who. Okay, do you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
And so what this is coming to is in this connotation of Revelation. Revelation's chapter 2, who is he referring to? Which group of the three are the Jews, would say they are Jews but are not? And it's clearly to me coming back to a spiritual conversion of Christians. It's a Christian following that became, by the virtue of the promise of Christ's grace, once you embrace the Holy Spirit, follow that to discipleship with Christ, you become basically a Judahite, or the promised tribe grafted into his bloodline of David. Mm-hmm. That's the spiritual promise.
Now, when someone is called, and usually this is always done unfairly, I think, unless someone's outwardly, espousing racism against any group of people, when someone refers to another as an anti-Semite or anti-Semitic, they don't realize that the Semites were both Jews or Judeans and Arabs.
Arabs of the line of Esau, and the Edomites, they're all Semitic. I mean, it's just the actual genealogical bloodline structures. Yeah,
but we have these political games being played and religious games being played, differentiating between the two groups. They all come from the same bloodline.
That's correct. And so, yeah, it can be confusing to the average person just trying to make sense out of the New Testament with, and then of course, There's well-meaning Christians that say we should honor and support the Jews because it says so in the New Testament. Well, again, you got to go back and find out what the term Jew represents. It could very well mean Christians. It very likely means Christians that have been adopted to become the tribe of Judah. This doesn't have anything to do with the Khazarian Babylonian sect. And I got to reemphasize the Talmud is the official name of the Talmud is the Babylonian Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Judean Babylonian / Pharisaical rabbi writings entail the Talmud. And that's, you know, for the most part, that is the book of today's so-called Jewish people. Okay. So that needs to be really clarified in scholarly papers, and I don't think it's been done. Thus, people are wandering around in the dark, bumping their heads against walls and posts and stumbling blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't get it.
Now, you mentioned the relationship on the previous show, I was sitting in as a co-producer on Third Stream View, and right before my show, and we were talking about the relationship of the Turks and Germany in regard to World War II, but this goes back, really, the Turks, known as the Khazars, way back, let's say, between the 6th and the 11th centuries, in southern Russia, allegedly all converted to Judaism around the 8th century. It sounds like a pretext, doesn't it, to spread out and take control of finance and what have you. It mirrors what we're going through here in the States today, doesn't it?
It does. And in fact, again, it goes back to the statement I make in this paper that the first time the word or the term Jew actually appeared in these 18th century Bibles, it was in the first part of it is it appeared in the retranslations of 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 6. And this is very telling, very much a clue to what I'm talking about here as proof. 2 Kings 16, verse 6 describes an episode of a war between Israel and Judah. Oh, okay, see what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
This begins to be really confusing as you understand the machinations of these conspirators here. Israel and Judah, it describes Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the king of Israel. Pekah went to war with the wicked Ahaz, the king of Judea, Babylonia. Yet we read in the new translation, well, in the 1700s, the Syrians, quote, drove the Jews from Elath. Wait a minute. Here we see that the Jews are actually at war with the true Israel. And so we got to find out who the true Israel is after this war during the era of 2 Kings. And it's so amazing. We find that there are a total of 6 Israel kings of true Israel, the true lineage of Judah, that these 6 kings actually, because of the Babylonian, Judean civil wars there and the movement, they actually went into the land northward. They inhabited the land northward. They became known in the Roman texts, the 6 kings, Roman numeral 6, V1, VI, Vi kings, the 6 kings. That's where they came to reside in the Northland, the North Scandinavia into the Baltic states, the southern part of the Baltic states. That becomes very interesting when you realize really the large bulk of people killed in World War II and the ethnic cleansing that occurred under Milosevic in the 90s in Bosnia, Herzegovina. This bloodline of the Vikings, these bloodlines of the 6 kings, seems to be a real problem to the controlling so-called Khazarian Babylonians. For what, you know, and this is something that's been going on again since 600 BC. That's what's amazing. They just have some kind of a blood debt, vendetta, that most historians, because of the obfuscation that Christian Bibles, don't understand.
Yes, it raises a question, too. When Moses referred to the land of Canaan, the promised land, the land of milk and honey, he was speaking about the land which was west of the Jordan River in ancient Palestine. And this land was conquered, as it stated in history, and occupied by the Israelites in the latter part of the second millennium. Well, that's referring to 1948. It's an interesting definition. It's not telling the whole truth, is it?
No, I think, again, it goes back. There's so many changes made by these Episcopalian bishops and Catholic fathers during this this time frame that it's very difficult for the average lay person, you know, to make sense of it. And this is what I hope to accomplish with this paper, kind of get people at least to think and do their own digging as I have done, hopefully come to the same conclusion. So getting back to the definition of the Revelation chapter 2, verse 9, for he says the Jews that are not Jews, which, you know, which say they are Jews but are not. Well, it's not referring to the tribe of Judah per se. It's talking about not the literal tribe, but those that have spiritually become adopted into them. Okay, you say they are Christians, it's the best description, but are not Christian. They are wolves in sheep's clothing. Because the other contexts of chapter 2 talks about something else, the so-called doctrine of the Nicolaitans. Now, what is that all about? You know, there's just a couple of references where Christ there warns the disciples to beware of the so-called doctrine of the Nicolaitans. This is found again in chapter 2, verse 6. Now, there's also the Isle of Pergamos. Now, this is really an amazing little clue given here as well, because Christ says the doctrine of the Nicolaitans is practiced there in Pergamos, where Satan's seat is located, as well as they practice the doctrine of Baal or Balaam. Wow, what does that mean? Is that truly something to be discovered? I think it's a huge clue. What have you ever heard that? This is not the doctrine of Nikolov. It's the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. Have you ever heard that term before?
Is that related to ancient Mysia, which would be, let's say, Western Asia Minor, in the vicinity of Izmir, Turkey?
Well, not really. It's if you look at the term Nicolaitan, again, it goes. You have to go back to the etymology to understand if this is a tribe. Is that what you're? You know, I kind of thought the same thing at first.
Or is it naming it after, let's say, maybe an emperor or a king? Like,
no, it's an actual description of a concept. Okay, this is so important. Nicolaitan is a combination. Again, you got English translators trying to make sense of Greek words that are kind of disjointed, and they put them together to form a word that English people don't know what anything about. Nicolaitan is a combination of three Greek words, Don. John, the writings of John was first translated from the Aramaic into the Greek, from the Greek then into the Latin, then into English. The three words are the Greek words nikos, N-I-K-O-S, which means conquest, victory, triumph, people being conquered, and by implication, dominancy over the defeated. Nikos, N-I-K-O-S, is the root word of the modern basketball shoe or athletic shoe, Nike.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to conquer that victory, you wear the Nikes, you're victorious. So Nikos. Second word, Laos, L-A-O-S. We know of Laos, the country, but Laos in the Greek means the laity, the common people, the people. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the final word is ton, T-O-N, meaning all genders, all people, male and female exclusively. So Nikolaitan, literally in Greek, is a doctrine whereby a powerful spiritual, structural, hierarchical chain of command is established to control and conquer this people spiritually as well as temporally. In other words, the shepherds of the flock are not really the shepherds. They become the ones to come and shear the flock and to get rich off the flock and keep control over the flock. This is Christ said he hates this doctrine. That's a strong word for Christ, the author of love. But this doctrine, he hates it because it places lords. It puts people in a position of power over God's heritage, his people. And if you read 1 Peter chapter 5, 1 through 3, this is what Peter was explaining when he exhorts the elders of the churches to work as overseers, but not for dishonest gain, he says, but being examples to the flock. In other words, being a servant to them is the first and highest calling. Wow. Isn't that absolutely so true in all these false religions? These religions set up with hierarchical structures of cardinals, of bishops, of confessors, and on the top, a god-man, a demigod named a pope. And that's the Catholic religion, of course, but then look at others. In the American continent, you have the Mormon faith, where the general authorities, the hierarchical structure there is, the infallibility quotient is so powerful that when, the Mormon faithful believe that when their prophet, their head, speaks that, it's God speaking, and they can't question or think for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's the danger of these totalitarian regimes of all kind. Whether it's a faith, a church, a synagogue, or just a political structure like the Khmer Rouge, the communist regimes of North Korea, the Kim Il-jungs, the Mao, the Stalin regimes. You question the leader, you question der Führer, well, you openly question, you will end up in a gulag or worse. See, this is the doctrine that Christ hates, because I submit is the doctrine of his opposite number. It's the satanic doctrine, the Pol Pot, Khmer Rouge, the Mormon faith, the Catholic faith. It's all a central theme, you see.
Mm-hmm.
The doctrine of the Nicolaitans, the doctrine of those who would conquer and rule over the laity, the common people. I was just amazed when I figured that out by just figuring out the term Nicolaitan coming from the Greek.
There's the word deacon also. I mean, you mentioned the bishops and cardinals, and the word deacon is usually a person who is ordained as a minister, yet below the rank of a priest, and is assisting the priest in secular affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a, would you say that that's a traditionally a political liaison of the church?
A middle, well, yeah, it's all part of the hierarchical structure, which again is a component of this so-called doctrine of the Nicolaitans. In the original gospel of Jesus Christ, if you really can read it with a clear eye, there was never meant to be any of this structure. That, you know, he gave some pastors, some priests, and that for the teaching, for the edification, for the helping of those weak in the faith. But once they all reached the unity of the faith, there were all that. They were all equal. There were unity there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference. And you've got young or individuals in a lower rung hierarchy, but the central theme is the general membership of the synagogue or congregation, as the case may be, is just to be able to keep the people under the thumb of the authority, the so-called authority of the priestly class. And again, it's give me your money, give me your tithes, give me your offerings, give me your labor. You know, it's like a master and a slave structure. The second part I want to talk about, and I do in this paper, Don, is the Isle of Pergamos, the island where Satan's throne is said to have been, and from there the seat of Baal, the abomination, the doctrine of Baal worship. Well, if you research the island of Pergamos, you find some very interesting things going on there. There was in the 1920s, there was a German archaeological expedition that they were digging into the early strata of the Isle of Pergamos, and they found an ancient temple structure there indeed. It was a Baal worshiping temple, but they uncovered a stone throne, and it's called the throne of Pergamos, the so-called throne of which Satan actually sat and ruled, went to rule the world. The story continues that Adolf Hitler, when he came to power in the 30s, brought this throne of Satan right into Berlin, and he set it up there in the Colosseum, the Nazi, you know, arena. And it was this throne that he sat on again to direct the new order, the so-called Third Reich. Isn't that an amazing? Amazing story. If you look at the picture, I wish I had a way to video conference this, but there are actual pictures of this throne of Pergamos there on the web. The stone carvings on this throne are amazing to me, because guess what they depict? They depict various phases of man and half man, half serpent, half dragon.
Any surprise there?
Wow, it just, to me, it's stunning. When Berlin fell at the end of World War II, it's interesting that the Soviets took the throne of Pergamos as war booty. They took it to Moscow, and there we have the communist rulers using it as well, but they had some very disastrous, almost supernatural, demonic possessions going on with that, so much so that I believe it was in the 1950s, early 60s, they transferred this accursed throne back to Berlin, and it sits in the museum there in downtown Berlin to this day.
Do you think Hitler used that during the Olympics when Jesse Owens?
Yeah, he did.
Did he?
He was there. It was used. It was his basically. I don't know if it was there for public viewing, but it was definitely in that Nazi Coliseum.
Huh.
And he did, in fact, sit on it. Well, here's where it gets kind of interesting. Inside sources have kind of leaked this out that candidate Barack Hussein Sotoro Obama actually took a pre-election visit to Berlin. The Illuminati power brokers there there was a midnight ceremony concerning him and the throne of Pergamos there in Berlin. That would explain the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, there in Bronco Stadium. If you remember right, Don, they had it all set up to look like a Greek temple.
Mm-hmm.
And even the inauguration was in the Greek temple motif. Well, again, Pergamos is the Greek island. It's Greek. That's where the throne of Satan originated. I think that's just, again, a very strong clue as to the satanic cult nature of this administration and those behind the scenes.
Now, I remember reading something along the lines of Pergamos being a code name for Rome. I don't know if you came across that. I can't remember where I read it or under what context, but
I hadn't found that at all. All I could find that Pergamos is indeed a very real, legitimate island, a place, and indeed there was archaeological work done that verified everything there in Revelation chapter 2. Again, it's not just some myth or fairy tale. In fact, the Germans, especially the Nazis, took this very seriously. Of course, we know that Adolf Hitler was completely bankrolled by and protected by the Vatican, which had a very strong liaison with Italian dictator Mussolini. In fact, it was Mussolini in 1929 that recognized for the first time and gave complete independent nation status to the Vatican and basically set them apart as a kingdom unto their own self.
Well, it's no surprise that we see the Ashkenazis are Satanists and practice satanic ritual on all fronts, really. Symbolically, numerologically, in their deeds and their methods for creating wars and murdering millions of people. I mean, you know, is this of God or is this of a demon?
Yeah. Right. And it comes back, and I kind of wrote out a checklist for those who would claim to be true Christians to see if their organization fits the criteria of embracing the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which is basically 6 points. First checklist, you need to ask, does your organization give excessive glory and honor to a select group of men? Yes or no. 2, do they demand complete allegiance and blind obedience from the membership? 3, is questioning of these leaders openly or covertly deemed to be a mortal sin? 4, has the organization become wealthy and politically powerful? 5, have the so-called clergy been engaged in offensive immorality such as polygamy, polyandry, or molestation of children on a large scale, yes or no? And 6, does the organization, a.k.a. synagogue, seek to control the entire world?
That leaves out most TV evangelists, doesn't it?
Maybe.
I mean, you know, if the answer is yes, you know.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So let me go into the second part of this in Revelation chapter 2 is the doctrine of Baal, the worship of Baal, B-A-A-L. And I go, you know, I don't much care if people like this or not anymore. You know, as an ex-devout Mormon who was been to the LDS temple and done the rituals, helped even officiate in the rituals, there's one part of that I just want to say word for word here. It's a depiction in this Garden of Eden setting where Satan appears to come to deceive Eve, and he does prevail upon her to partake of the fruit, so-called fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And Eve, immediately her eyes become open, and she looks over and she sees Satan as if for the first time. And she knows that Satan has on a very interesting garment, an apron around his waist going down to his thighs. Eve then asks, "What is that apron you have on?" Satan replies, "It is the emblem of my priesthoods and power." Eve, priesthoods? Satan replies, "Yes, priesthoods." Again, let me just emphasize, he's saying this is an emblem of my priesthoods in the plural and power singular. It doesn't have powers plural. He has great power and his priesthoods are plural. He has numerous priesthoods. Now, that's what's amazing, Don, is to me, I look back at that when I was going and being initiated in the Mormon temple. I don't know why I didn't get it. I really don't. Here, you've just been explained to you what the apron is, that an apron is a symbol of satanic priesthood. And I swear, not 5 minutes later, Satan orders the initiates to put an apron on. And they don't even question. They just do it. I did it. I didn't even stop to think. Because, you see, it's like the sheep going over a cliff or the lemmings going over a cliff. Oh, if everybody's doing it, oh, here we go. You know? Peer pressure.
Priesthoods in that sense would have meant the domination over all the various religions, whatever they were at that time.
Yeah, and this again goes back to, again, the sister doctrine of the Nicolaitan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in Catholicism, guess what? The popes have all worn an apron when they do their vestures and their cleansing. The apron is also called the Gremiale, spelled G-R-E-M-I-A-L-E. Wow. You know what the gremial is? It's, again, it comes to the Greek term. Gremi is a class of demons. The word of the English word is gremlin. And ale is worshiping them or honoring that class of demons. Isn't that just amazing?
Mm-hmm.
So Mormons have the green apron on. There's ancient carvings and paintings in Babylon, and the archaeological excavations of the Tigris, between the Tigris and Euphrates River, these ancient temples. The Babylonian priests had the apron, the gremial, on as well. I show in this paper the picture of Ratzinger wearing his white papal gremial, and amazingly, there's the upside down inverted cross on the apron,
as he has on his throne too.
Yeah, yeah, man, this is incredible. Also, I came across, as I was just looking for other examples of famous people who wore this aprons, the Masons all have their Masonic apron on. It's, again, an emblem of satanic priesthoods. Of course, I don't think the majority of Shriners and or other Masons, especially in the B'nai B'rith, I don't think the majority know at all what this symbolizes. They just do it because the whole club and crowd is doing it. But there's a picture of Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna's Masonic apron. Wow. It's under glass. There's a picture of it there in the Masonic Museum in Houston, Texas. Wow. To the fact that here's a devout Catholic, Santa Anna, well known with his ruthless dictatorship, his, again, demand as a Nicolaitan for complete loyalty. He would have his own troops shot for disobedience. He was the self-described Napoleon of Mexico. I mean, this guy was ruthless.
Now, True, if I can interject with a question here, as far as your knowledge and experience of these aprons, are these intended to be symbolic of a hidden power, or is it understood that those that wear these aprons have achieved that level of power and they're to be revered as other leaders in the church?
Well, there's a guy named Bill Schnabelin who's written about this a little bit. He was Mormon, Masonic, Catholic, all these, and he was actually a high priest in Lucifer, or a Wicca in witchcraft. And he maintains that his teachings in witchcraft, his Wicca, says that the apron is, in this term, especially with any stitching or embroidery, whether it's fig leaves or symbols or whatever, it's kind of like it brings in sexual energy to the bearer. It's kind of like a kundalini amplifier. And that could be. But again, it goes back to the term, the Catholic term, or in this case, the Greek. The gremial, you know, the honoring of the class of gremlins, the prankster demons. I really think that's, you know, what's in a name? Well, a whole lot in this case.
I don't know if I'd want a seeing, all-seeing eye in a Mason's compass down there. If you know what I mean.
But kind of pointy, isn't it? All-seeing eye. But, you know, the Hopi Indians have their dances that have been performing in their kachinas, or their kivas, for at least 2,000 years in their oral tradition. I was fortunate enough to be invited, oh golly, it's been about 10 years ago now, to go down and witness some of these dances in the kivas, and it's amazing. They have two sorts of dancers that depict the good spirits of their forefathers, the healthy ones. These are, it's called kachinas. The evil ones that come to make war and to cause problems are called ogres. And they're all ogre kachinas. The unique thing is every single one of the ogre kachinas that I witnessed have aprons on.
Yeah, and it's strange. Now, you say that this is also connected to Baal. Some pronounce that Baal, but when I think of Baal, I think of bailout. You know, so.
Well, I call it Baal. Baal, like if you worship Baal, you're into a real nasty Baal movement.
I get
so,
that.
Yeah, in the LDS scripture, the Bible, LDS Bible Dictionary, they actually have a definition for Baal there. I pulled it up, and here's the Mormon dictionary definition, and it's pretty much the same in the concordances of Strong's and others. Baal, Lord, means Lord or possessor. The sun god and the male or generative principle in nature. The word Baal expresses the relation between lord and slave, etc. The prophets call Baal the shame. Ashtoreth was the goddess generally worshipped along with Baal. Well, again, see that? See how those things correlate? The Baal, the sun god, also known as Lord or Possessor, and he represents the relation between Lord and slave, going back again to the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which is, again, just that very thing again, see? Mm-hmm. It's correlated. Baal is Lord. Everybody that is, you know, that he has worshiping him are slaves. It's Lord-slave relationship, you see.
So worshiping the sun goddess, in this case Ashtoreth, is a roundabout way of worshiping Baal, then.
Well, Baal is actually the male principle. His mm-hmm. consort, or his wife, if you will, worship along with him is Ashtoreth. She's represented as the feminine moon goddess. So sun is masculine, moon is feminine, Ashtoreth is the moon symbol.
Okay.
So we see, again, in the Judaic Encyclopedia, we read about Baal. Baal is still thought of today as a Canaanite fertility deity. The great Baal was of Canaan. Or in other words, I found he ruled over the seed of Cain, also known as the Kenites. The encyclopedia goes on to say he was a son of El, the high god of Canaan. The cult of Baal celebrated annually his death and resurrection as part of the Canaanite fertility rituals. These ceremonies often included human sacrifice and temple prostitution. In times of great turbulence, human sacrifices, particularly children, were made to the great god Moloch. Now, I want to just parenthetically say there that the word temple, means house of, temp is home or house of abode, of El, the Lord, okay? A very closely related word to that, to tempel, is broth. El, which is again the Canaanite temple prostitution or house of the rising sun.
Or you remember that? You could say hotel.
Hostel. It's a place to reside. But
I was El, making it more colloquial.
Yeah, I understand. But see, brothel. Remember the song, "The House of the Rising Sun," down in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
This is what really the temple becomes. It's in the ancient Babylonian structure, it was a place of prostitution. It was a place, again, that Baal wants to ordain. And isn't it funny that your Jewish mafia control so much of these brothels, the pornography that comes out, all of these houses of immorality are tied back to these same organized crime figures again.
See, okay? Now another term that comes to mind is El Grotto, which is a name used by some of these secret Masonic groups. Generally, I think they're like the retirees, like Shriners. El Grotto. A grotto being a cave, can be an indoor type of cave inside a building or something resembling a cave, or it can actually be a real cave.
Well, that goes back again to the code name for the Vatican, the St. Peter's Basilica. I don't know if you knew this or not, Don, but there was the ancient El Grotto, the cave of Mithra, the cult of the moon, of the moth goddess, the moth god, Mothman. Okay, this is a very dark demonic entity that the entrance of the catacombs is basically the cave of Mithra, and this is of course where St. Peter's Basilica was built, over the top of the cave of Mithra. El Grotto, the grotto, the cave structure.
It all connects, doesn't it?
It seems to. Finally, and we don't know, we're getting low on time here. The final paragraph of this, the religion of the god Baal, this is from the Judaic Encyclopedia, the religion of the great god Baal was widely accepted among the ancient Jews. Again, this is the term Jew was a modern word. It actually means the ancient Judeans or Babylonians. And although it was put down at times, it was never permanently stamped out. The god's images of male face extending out of the sunburst was erected on many buildings. Within the religion, there appeared to be numerous priests and various classes of devotees. Again, there's that hierarchical structure again. During the ceremonies, they wore appropriate robes. The ceremonies included burning of incense. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
And offering burnt sacrifices, occasionally consisting of human victims. The officiating priests would call upon Baal by blowing on horns, dancing around the altars, chanting frantically, and cutting themselves with knives to inspire the attention and compassion of the god. In the Bible, Baal is also called Beelzebub, one of the fallen angels of Lucifer and Satan. That's from end quote of the Judaic Encyclopedia. And I just say that because the Nauvoo, Illinois Mormon Temple originally in the 1840s had these stones cut to resemble the sun god, this Baal image. Where in the world did Joseph Smith get this from? He didn't have a book on this, I don't think. He had to have gotten this from some kind of occultic revelation. But it surely filled the ancient record to a T, I'll tell you.
I have this feeling that he was merely an agent carrying this out, you know, and it goes back to the banking families of the Illuminati and the their obsession with things satanic.
I think so.
That's a hunch, but I don't see it any other way. How could he have been influenced? Everyone wants to believe this idea that he was somehow, he had this sacred encounter, let's say, you know, so sort of like Moses, as if he was a modern day Moses.
In reality, I can tell you, it makes me spend another whole hour on this. I have very, very strong evidence that I could convince any jury in the land, I believe, that Joseph Smith, as a young 14-year-old boy, was taught how to, and the correct usage of Amanita muscaria mushrooms, which, of course, the so-called sacred grove there in New York was full of these. The birch trees are symbiotic with the Amanita muscaria in the spring of the year when the snow's still on the ground, which is when he went into the grove. I think, well, I strongly believe he ingested those the mushroom just in the right amount to get an epiphany, to receive a hallucinogenic vision. And to him, it was very, very real. It was, he pierced the veil. He communicated with what he thought was a deity, a figure. But the point is, studies have been done on Amanita muscaria, in, studies in Germany, and 100% of the test subjects have exactly the same physical symptoms that Joseph Smith described happened to him. Almost word for word, in fact.
It's as though it's a portal that's being opened to a demonic realm.
In the early spring, the Amanita muscaria pokes its white head up in through the moist soil, and if heaven forbid, it looks just like a phallus, you know, a erect phallus.
Mm-hmm.
It does. It looks like somebody lost their dildo sitting up there, and it's white. When the mushroom head begins to come out again, it looks like a circumcised penis. It looks just like it. In fact, at that stage, it's starting to break open where the head starts to come up, the mushroom cap. At that point, believe it or not, it's called piercing the veil. That's the terminology given in mycology. It pierces the veil of the mushroom head. You can see the actual veil starting to shred as it opens up.
Mm-hmm.
At that point is when there's the most powerful hallucinogenic toxins are produced to indeed pierce the veil of the dimensions. But this is not something that Jesus Christ wants to have you do. It's something that Lucifer, the god of this earth, wants you to do. He wants you to become one with his soil, one with the hallucinogenic, mind-altering properties. You know, Christ teaches to you through the still small voice of the Spirit and the voice of love, and always wants you to keep your faculties intact. But that's not the other side.
Yeah, what's the period of time that one is under such an influence? Is that a matter of hours, or does this go on for weeks or months?
Hours. The properties affect the neural nerves of the brainstem, and it typically lasts 2 to 3 hours, and then you're left with some muscular weaknesses and other symptoms. That's exactly what Joseph Smith again recorded after his trips. He had muscle weakness to the point where he couldn't even, you know, climb a fence. He collapsed. And that's, again, so typical of studies done to develop, you know, to measure the neuropsychological effects of these toxins.
Now, did anyone in these test subjects feel a compulsion to start a new religion?
They did, in fact.
Really?
Yeah. The final phase of the Amanita muscaria is in the autumn of the year, right around the autumn solstice, around September 21st. Believe it or not, these red-capped mushrooms, as the first cold weather and the first frost and the days shorten, they actually turn a bright, shimmering golden color, and they're literally called the golden plate stage. And individuals, again, testing these qualities, that's a whole different neural toxic effect than the early stage. But half of the test subjects, not all of them now, about half, had a interconnection with an angelic presence, they said, and they actually began to want to translate an ancient text into a book form and to teach people and form a new religion. Absolutely. Joseph Smith was out with a gunny sack in the woods in September 21st, which is the autumn solstice, getting the golden plates, the mushrooms.
Well, we're about out of time, but I'm sure we'll pick this up again. I'd be interested in the feedback that you get from this piece. I'm going to be posting this on my website probably first thing tomorrow morning, directlightproductions.com. And I'm sure you probably have this at your site, atruat.org. Is that correct?
I haven't posted it yet. It'll probably be on the battlehymn.com website. I believe it's there now under One World Religion.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't really have an axe to grind here with this. You're just after the truth and sort of connecting the dots here, and I commend the work. It certainly touches upon many things that I'm familiar with, and I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with this. Great sewing you did there, Doc.
Well, it's an ongoing working process. Okay, well, good night to you, Don. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to next week.
All right, the show on the microeffect.com Monday through Wednesday is called The Story Behind the Story. Our guest has been Dr. Atruat. And Dr. Atruat, I wish you a good evening, and look forward to your visit next Monday as well.
Indeed. Good night, Don.
Good night. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. Again, Dr. Atruat, Ph.D. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network. Also want to thank Don Newsom on the sound at BBS Radio this evening. Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow night when my special guest will be herbalist, historian, and chemist, along with musician and environmental scientist, Mr. Michael Anthony. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.